Over the past few years, a federal task force has arrested more than 200 gang members in an unexpected place, the tree-lined suburbs along the Hudson River in New York. Drug traffickers with ties to the Bloods and the Latin Kings have put down roots there. Authorities say they've brought shootings and stabbings with them. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports.
Middletown, New York is 90 minutes from the city. On West Main Street, you can find tidy brick buildings from the 1800s, a brew pub, and a restaurant that sells fresh mussels and escargot. But last month, a law enforcement task force used helicopters and SWAT teams to find something else.
With their hands in cuffs, more than 20 suspected members of the violent Blood Street Gang are escorted into the FBI regional office.
The indictment says the group operated like a criminal machine, pushing cocaine and heroin from the Bronx into New York's northern suburbs. For 3 months, authorities tracked them using wiretaps and cameras set up on telephone poles and trees. Manhattan U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara is best known for prosecuting Wall Street executives, but he says preventing gang bloodshed is his top priority. It all began when he sat down in upstate New York with a group of moms.
When you think, what is the worst thing you can hear from somebody? It was this. A mother there talked about how she had lost her own son to gang violence in Newburgh, New York, and it made a big impression on me and the other people in that room. And then when you think, what could be worse than that? We listened to the next mom who spoke, who said she had lost two sons.
Violent crime is at historic lows in New York City, but here in Middletown, reports of violence ticked up last year, and some neighboring towns have the highest rate of attacks per capita in the state. One incident, a stabbing connected to the Bloods gang, took place at a local diner. That's where I caught up with Ruben Rivera on a chilly morning as he picked up his breakfast.
Is it safe to go around outside around here now, or no?
No. We gotta do something, no.
Rivera has lived in Middletown for more than 20 years, raised 9 children here. Yeah. It used to be quiet, he says. Now Rivera tells his youngest daughter to stay inside at night. 10 minutes away at the Middletown Police Department, an officer takes an accident report in the front room while Lieutenant Greg Matakis describes the gang presence in the city.
Whereas in the past it was somewhat, I would guess you could say, underground. Now they're a little bit more open, they're more willing to display colors and things of that nature.
Back in New York, the sheer number of law enforcement officers in the city makes it hard for big gangs to meet openly there the way they did back in the 1980s. So many gang members have left state prison and migrated north. Less heat, more opportunity. Head up the elevator in a nondescript office building a few miles away and you'll find District Attorney Frank Phillips. He moved there last year after a hurricane flooded his old building. But Phillips, who served as the top county prosecutor since 1986, has another plague on his mind, gang leaders in his community.
These are the drug-addicted street urchins that are being swept up for statistical purposes. These are the real movers and shakers behind the level of violence that's being committed on our citizens throughout the county.
Phillips welcomes help from federal authorities who have the resources to wiretap gang members and conduct surveillance.
If they can keep taking the top echelons down, I think that will go a long way to keeping a lid on the violence as best we can.
The man on the front lines is FBI agent James Galliano. He runs the Safe Streets Task Force in the area, 10 FBI agents and 20 more officers from federal, state, and local agencies.
We use these drug cases to compel cooperation, which in turn allows us to go after the folks that are doing the shootings and the stabbings.
The strategy works like this. Long before they bring any criminal charges, investigators try to identify the key leaders in the gang. They look at whether those kingpins may have prior drug and weapons convictions, which expose them to decades more in the federal prisons. That leverage could help prosecutors pressure them to plead guilty. Prosecutor Richard Zabel says if gang members cooperate with authorities, they can help unlock other mysteries.
Often we are able to solve what have been unsolved homicides, long-term unsolved homicides.
Galliano, the FBI agent, says he has a bigger responsibility than just solving crimes. He coaches basketball to kids from the rougher neighborhoods.
It also gives me an opportunity to interface with some of these young kids at a young age before the Bloods or the Latin Kings or La M.A. or the Bankard Barrio Kings or Mad Drama or any of these other gangs get their claws into these kids.
He still sees some kids follow a dangerous path, but Galliano says he has the attitude of a guy who watches forests. He'll clear out the deadwood, but stick around to help the young trees grow straight. Carrie Johnson, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Spool back in time 150 years to the summer of 1862. The Civil War is raging, and President Abraham Lincoln is starting to scribble away at a document, an ultimatum to the rebellious states: return to the Union or your slaves will be freed. Emancipation was a military necessity, the president later confided to his cabinet. Lincoln called it absolutely essential to the preservation of the Union. We must free the slaves, Lincoln said, or be ourselves subdued.
He knew that emancipation would start the tidal wave of freedom and that it was irreversible once it started. But he also knew that more work would be required.
That's Lincoln scholar Harold Holzer, who offers a rethinking of the Emancipation Proclamation in his new book titled Emancipating Lincoln. It's his 42nd book on Lincoln and the Civil War. To those revisionist critics who now say the proclamation was weak, delayed, insufficient, and insincere, Holzer counters, not so. He says Lincoln very carefully calibrated the timing and delivery of this act.
He did things in this run-up that are perplexing, sometimes unattractive, sometimes scary, to prepare the country in his mind for what was going to be a revolutionary moment.
Remember, the country was at war. The stubborn culture of racism made a pro-freedom policy a perilous idea. Lincoln knew it could bring down his administration and the Union. Holzer says Lincoln had to fear a virulent backlash from conservative Northern Democrats opposed to racial equality. And he risked triggering secession from the border states, the slave-owning states that had not joined the Confederacy, Maryland, Delaware, Missouri, and above all, his birth state, the crucially strategic Kentucky.
Lincoln worried that he wanted to have God on his side, but he must have Kentucky.
So it was in that context, in August of 1862, that Lincoln hosted at the White House a deputation of free Negroes, prominent African Americans. His message to them, it was not, you shall be free. No, it was this: it is better for us both to be separated.
And he blames them for the war. Says this, you know, if it wasn't for your presence here, as if it was voluntary in the beginning, this wouldn't be happening. Go where the ban is not upon you, he tells them. Go to the Caribbean, go to Africa. Yeah, they're cruel words, they're harsh words, they're unfriendly.
So how to understand this bitter pill of prejudice, as Holzer calls it? Well, he says it's telling that President Lincoln had summoned newspaper reporters to that meeting.
He wanted this message out. And what's important to keep in mind is that he had written the Emancipation Proclamation. It was languishing in a drawer. It was burning a hole in his pocket. He knew he was going to do this, but he wanted Northern Americans who were dubious about marching toward racial equality to be assured that he was not doing this for the black race. He was doing this for the Union, to reunite the country, to defeat the rebellion, and he had no concern about blacks, their feelings, their residence. He does have his finger in the wind.
Holzer says Lincoln was trying to mold public opinion to make the proclamation palatable. And the president was waiting for the right moment, a Union victory on the battlefield, which finally came at Antietam. Within a week of that victory, Lincoln gave the rebellious states 100 days to obey this ultimatum.
Either return to your legal balance with the Union and this rebellion, or your slaves will be then, henceforward, and forever free.
There was an immediate backlash. Lincoln's Republican Party was punished at the polls in the 1862 elections. Then, on January 1st, 1863, Lincoln was to issue the final decree at the White House.
It was New Year's Day, and by tradition, there was a party. And Lincoln went downstairs early and began receiving guests, and the afternoon comes and goes, and African Americans are gathered in churches. Telegraph operators are already keyed up to bring the glorious news to the church whenever it arrived, and nothing happens.
Why the delay? Well, as Harold Holzer tells it, Lincoln had found a mistake in the handwritten proclamation brought for his signature. The whole thing had to be redone. Back it went to the scribe. It took hours.
And then something fascinating happened. He picked up his pen and put it down. And then he picked it up again and put it down. And people in the room wondered, well, maybe he isn't going to issue it after all. Maybe he just can't bring himself to do it. And then he suddenly began rubbing his fingers with his other hand, rubbing his right hand with his left. And he said, you know, I've been shaking hands for hours, and my hand is almost paralyzed. If I sign the proclamation in a quaking hand, even though my whole heart is in it, people will look at my signature in 100 years and think he hesitated. And he just continued to massage his hand, and then he picked up the pen and signed his full name, which he only did on official documents. And then he looked at the signature, Abraham Lincoln, and said very proudly, there, that will do.
Those words, that will do, just seem like such a paltry way of encapsulating what had just happened.
Well, he had said right before that, if my name ever goes into history, it will be for this act. I think he sensed immediately that he had become one of the immortals.
One misconception about the Emancipation Proclamation would be that once it's signed, boom, slaves are free. Far from that.
Far from that.
Far indeed. Some areas of the South that had already fallen under Union control were not covered by the proclamation. Also exempt were the four border states that owned slaves but had not seceded, so nearly 500,000 people remained enslaved there. And in the Confederate states, freedom came only as the Union soldiers advanced.
Soldiers were armed with these tiny reproductions of the Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln had ordered hundreds of thousands of them printed. Suppose an officer gets to a plantation owner that might not understand what he had to sacrifice. Here it is. These guys are free. You got to pay them or let them go, one or the other. And that's how it worked, mile by mile in Southern Territory.
On the cover of Harold Holzer's book is an engraving that shows a scene from April 4th, 1865. It's President Lincoln holding the hand of his young son, Tad, as he enters Richmond, Virginia, just 2 days after Confederate forces had fled their capital. Jubilant African Americans toss their hats in the air as they greet him.
They rushed over to him and cheered and knelt. And Lincoln famously said, and there were witnesses there, please don't kneel to me. You must kneel only to God and thank him for your freedom. This was Lincoln's real emancipation moment. These black workers were actually that moment free under the terms of the proclamation. Here is the Emancipation Proclamation in action. We know also that one particularly wizened old man who was working on the dock was wearing a big straw hat. His reaction to Lincoln when he saw him was to doff this cap in a very grand way and bow to Lincoln. Lincoln took his cap off and tipped his hat to the black man. There were white women, mostly, the men had fled, hiding behind curtains on the second floor of the homes surrounding the shoreline, who were reported to have been looking on with horror at this simple but deeply moving and meaningful gesture. This was Lincoln acknowledging, after all the years of struggle, with the end finally in sight, that this was going to be a different society, a society of mutual respect and not subjugation.
But that moment of quiet triumph was fleeting. Just 10 days later, President Lincoln was assassinated. Harold Holzer's book is Emancipating Lincoln, The Proclamation in Text, Context, and Memory. You can see the engraving from the book jacket and other images inspired by the Emancipation Proclamation at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Several leading medical groups today issued new guidelines for cervical cancer screening. They recommend that women get screened far less frequently than doctors have long recommended. As we hear from NPR's Rob Stein, the new advice is the latest in a series of recommendations urging doctors and patients to be more cautious about common cancer screening tests.
More than 12,000 women are diagnosed with cervical cancer every year in the United States, and more than 4,000 die from the disease. For years, doctors have recommended that women start getting pap smears every year or two to try to catch any signs of cancer early when it's easiest to prevent and treat. Debbie Saslow is with the American Cancer Society.
Previously, we had said that screening should start either at age 21 or 3 years after the onset of sexual activity.
But after reviewing the latest scientific evidence, the Cancer Society and three other medical groups say that's not necessary. In fact, it's a bad idea. Most women should wait until they turn 21 and then only get tested every 3 years if everything looks okay.
This is the first time that we're saying we recommend against annual screening.
There are a couple of reasons for the change. First of all, cervical cancer is so rare among young women that there's no reason to start any earlier. And cervical cancer grows so slowly that there's no harm in waiting longer between tests.
If you compare the benefit of annual screening to screening every 3 years with the Pap test, it's almost nothing.
And more frequent testing can cause real problems. The Pap tests often produce false alarms. Those scares force women to undergo procedures to make sure there's no cancer.
There's time away from work. There's the discomfort, physical discomfort. There's the psychological anxiety.
And repeating those follow-up procedures over and over again can damage the cervix, causing serious problems later if women have children. Wanda Nicholson is with the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which is issuing almost identical recommendations. She says complications can include
preterm labor and then the birth of a premature infant or low birth weight infant.
For the first time, the guidelines also say that when women turn 30, they can get the Pap test along with a test for the human papillomavirus. HPV is a sexually transmitted virus that causes cervical cancer. If both tests come back negative, then most women can wait at least 5 years to get the tests again.
The addition of this HPV test adds so much accuracy to the result that screening more frequently than 5 years will again be more harmful and not more beneficial.
And the new guidelines say women can stop getting screened altogether once they turn 65 and everything still looks okay. Now, previous recommendations to cut back on other cancer tests, mammograms for breast cancer and PSA tests for prostate cancer, have been very controversial. The Cancer Society's Saslow acknowledges that whenever anyone talks about doing less medical care, it triggers fears about rationing.
When people hear less is potentially better, more is harmful, the assumption is you're rationing care, you're trying to save money.
But Saslow says that's not true. In fact, both Saslow and Nicholson say money was absolutely not a factor in changing the guidelines. Still, some doctors are a little worried that doing away with the annual exams will make some women forget to get their Pap tests or fail to come in for other tests that are important for a woman's well-being. Juan Felix is a cervical cancer expert at the University of Southern California.
We have to unlink the Pap test from the well-woman exam.
One of the big questions will be whether doctors are willing to follow these new guidelines and whether women will feel comfortable getting checked less often for cervical cancer. Rob Stein, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
A place where everyone is looking ahead eagerly, we must presume, to the opening of the Olympics this summer. NPR's London-based correspondent Philip Reeves sends us an occasional letter about the Games. His latest contains a warning for those planning to go to the Olympics. Phil says if you think you'll get around London easily just because you speak English, think again.
Americans and Britons enjoy sharing a mother tongue. I mean, we understand one another pretty well, don't we? Well, no, not always. English spoken by the British has some bizarre variants. One of the weirdest of these is found in the kingdom's capital. The Olympic Games will be based here, in East London, in one of the city's poorest parts. This isn't much like the London of Big Ben and Buckingham Palace. It's a drab, flat sprawl north of the River Thames. If you're planning to come, prepare to be baffled. People around here speak in code. Listen for a minute to EastEnders Nicola McCluskey and Jackie Dunning.
Apples and pears is stairs. Mince pies is eyes.
Daisy Roots is your boots.
Yeah.
The Olympics are being held in the heartland of Cockney rhyming slang. This odd linguistic device was introduced in Victorian times by Cockney market traders who wanted to avoid being overheard by the police. The Cockneys used to be working-class Londoners from the East End. Many have moved out of town and up the social ladder. These days in East London, you hear a vast range of languages, from Urdu to Polish. Yet Cockney rhyming slang continues to thrive.
People use it every day. I mean, we use it, we don't even know we're using it, do we? You know, you say something and it's just part of what we say. It's like our everyday speech sort of thing. Like I say to the girls, I'll just quickly run up the apples and pears.
My husband sat and taught my son Cockney rhyming slang right from being little, because it's important, yeah.
Oh, I've got loads of examples. Parts of the body, for example.
Gordon Smith collects Cockney rhyming slang for fun and puts it on his website, cockneyrhymingslang.co.uk.
Starting from the top, you've got your Barnet Fair, that's your hair. You've got your boat race, that's your face. You've got your I suppose, that's your nose. Mince pies, north and south.
Gregory Peck, what is that?
Well, that's your neck.
You see how it works, right? You take a word, let's say talk, replace it with a rhyming phrase, rabbit and pork, and drop the rhyming word. Thus, the word for talking too much in Cockney becomes a small furry animal. Four and a half months remain before the start of the Olympics. The verbal gymnastics have already begun. London's bloggers, including Smith, are busy compiling rhyming slang specially for the Games.
We've got the cycling, and the word bike is Dick Van Dyke in Cockney rhyming slang. Tennis players will be using balls, so that's Albert Halls. And these are all genuine Cockney expressions.
There's a rumour the rhyming slang for the Games themselves is the Sids, after the late Sid James. You may not have heard of him, but he was a big comedy star in Britain, thanks largely to the Carry On movies. EastEnders Nicola McCluskey and Jackie Dunning don't think the Sids will catch on.
I've not heard that one. No, see, there's a lot of new slang brought out by people, and like some of it, you have to say to them, what does that mean? Because it's not the true slang,
like,
is it?
What we were taught when we were younger.
It's fake.
And we won't have it. We want the true ones.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, London.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
People were evacuated and went home, you know, holding their shirts and their sweaters over their nose and mouths because there was this foul, black, thick smoke billowing into the air. And at the time, police were telling people that it was toxic and that they should leave the area as soon as possible. Now they're saying that, it wasn't really toxic.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, I'll share my thoughts in my weekly Can I Just Tell You essay. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we turn to the latest in our series for Women's History Month. As women around the world are rethinking and rewriting their own stories, we decided we wanted to dig into some biographies of notable women to see how these stories reflect those changes. So we're hearing about divas of all sorts. Today, we speak about leaders of nations, leaders who were not exactly known as exemplars of sugar and spice and everything nice, women like Cleopatra, who was called Serpent of the Nile, or Mary Tudor, known to history as Bloody Mary, the first queen to rule England. They are featured in a book series aimed at tween girls. It's called The Thinking Girl's Treasury of Dastardly Dames, and the books profile six women who earned both great power and great notoriety, some might say infamy. Here to tell us more is Shirin Yim Bridges. She is the editor and publisher of the series. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I should note that this is actually your second book series aimed at tween girls, although I think others will enjoy them other than tween girls. The first was called The Thinking Girl's Treasury of Real Princesses that was published in 2010. Could you first tell us how you got the idea, and second, tell us how that led to Dastardly Dames?
Well, the idea actually came when I saw my niece, Tegan, who was about 8 years old at the time, getting really fascinated by the Disney princesses. And I have a bit of an issue with some of the messages that those fairy tales tell young girls. It's about being pretty and sitting around waiting for a prince, and then the prince will come and happiness comes out after that. So I said to Tegan, did you know that in history, in real life, there have been lots of princesses who did great things, didn't sit around waiting for a prince, but actually went out and changed their own lives and changed history? And she didn't know, so we went looking for these books, and I was very surprised to find that these stories weren't being told to children. So I was already a children's author at that time, And so I decided I would have to write these stories. So that's how the first series came about.
Yeah, so how did that lead to Dastardly Dames? Because when I think about the kind of the biographies that people generally kind of seek out, particularly for younger children, you know, you think heroes and sheroes, the heroic, not too terribly morally complicated is generally the rule, right? And that's not them.
No. The Dastardly Dames also came out of me observing Tegan, because as she got a little older, she was very fascinated by darker, more macabre things. And I think that's a general trend. That's why Twilight and all these vampires and werewolves are so popular. And I thought, if you could harness that fascination and turn it into a power for the good, then you'd really have something going here. And they're so complex, these women. They lived in such challenging times, and they made such unexpected decisions. And all of them raise a very interesting question as to whether they would have been judged differently at a different time in history if a couple of different factors had gone different ways, or if they had been men.
There's been a lot of discussion about whether literature aimed at kids is too macabre, too involved with kind of difficult themes. And I think, you make the point that they're there anyway, number one. And number two, a lot of it, this is history. No, this is not history, but we'll start with Cleopatra, just because that's where your series starts. And just to get a sense of how she is remembered, I want to play a clip. No, okay, I know this is not history. This is the movies, but this is what we have. The 1963 film with, of course, Elizabeth Taylor, the legend, and Rex Harrison playing Julius Caesar. And here it is.
I have you now, Caesar. Besides, am I armies? And the simple fact that no mortal hand can destroy me.
Ah, yes. I seem to recall some mention of an obsession you have about your divinity. Isis, is it not?
I shall have to insist that you mind what you say. I am Isis. I am worshipped by millions who believe it.
First of all, one of the points that you make in the book is that the real Cleopatra did not look like Elizabeth Taylor. And the book kind of gives the historical narrative what is known, but you also raise questions of, did she really do this? What's the evidence? And why did she think she had to do this? How did you settle on that approach?
We wanted to present these women as complex, three-dimensional characters to give some balance to the stereotypes that are often out there, but also not to shy away or be afraid of the fact that they did make some very unpopular or immoral decisions. That was a general editorial approach that we took.
But are you trying to excuse them in a way from some of their nastier, truly dastardly deeds? Because some of them really are dastardly deeds.
No, I don't think that it's an apology either. You know, I don't think we're trying to excuse them, and we certainly don't condone a lot of things that they did. In fact, we get asked often why Cleopatra and Marie Antoinette are included in our series, because they've been so rehabilitated lately that there are people out there who say, why is Cleopatra a dastardly dame? She was a great queen. And our answer is that she was a great queen. She was a powerful queen, very intelligent woman, obviously so intellectually stimulating that she had two of the most powerful men of the time kind of fall at her feet, without being a great beauty, as you noted. But at the same time, she condoned, at the very least, if not encouraged or facilitated or even maybe connived, to have two of her brothers and one of her sisters murdered, which in our day and age, we would say, is a very dastardly thing. Although it was noted by Plutarch, the historian at the time, that all the best families did it, which I think is a wonderful quote. But my basic stance on this also is that when we started talking about doing the Dastardly Dames, we had a lot of people say, well, are you sure you want to do that? These aren't good role models. Why would you do that? And it kind of got all my feathers all roughed up, because I thought, we never ask this question about men. We never debate whether it's important to teach our children about powerful men, even if those powerful men were not saintly. You know, if a man is powerful and if he has affected history, we believe that our children should learn about him. But women who are powerful and have affected history, their stories don't get told because they weren't good enough. And I think that that's, first of all, unfair. And second of all, it gives children who are growing up nowadays a very biased view of what has been happening in history.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having the latest in our series of conversations Acknowledging Women's History Month, this month we decided to dig into biographies of notable women, and we decided to look at a series of books for tweens that profile some of history's most notorious and powerful women. We're speaking with Sharin Yim Bridges, the editor and publisher of the collection. In this collection, one of the things that tickled me a little bit is that you wrote one of the books yourself. It was Agrippina, the Roman Empress who was the mother of one of the empire's most notorious rulers, Nero. And I have it that Agrippina was so unloved that nobody else wanted to write the biography, so it fell to you. Her nickname was Atrocious and Ferocious. So tell us a little bit about her. She's one of the people, I think, whose name is probably less well-known unless you've studied the classics.
Yes, and once again, you know, sometimes you wonder why, because here's this woman. She was the sister of Caligula, very, very well-known name. The wife of Claudius, again, very well-known. The mother of Nero, again, really well-known. And then greatly hated in her time because she was so powerful and had so much influence over these men and had so much to do with the running of the state. And we're talking about the early Roman Empire, which is a period of history that is on every curriculum and very well studied, and yet we do not know her name. I think that that's such a travesty. So she did actually fall to me because when the authors were picking which topics they would most prefer to write, nobody picked poor Agrippina. But in a way, I'm really glad that she did. First of all, I love Roman history. And the other thing is that she was a challenge because finding her humanity was difficult. There's not that much that extant that has actually survived about her. And what was written by very hostile witnesses. But there are small details that I find in this woman who is formidable, very admirable. Towards the end of the story, you'll find that Nero, her son, tries to kill her, and he has her capsized at sea in a boat. And so you have to imagine that, you know, in the first century AD, this woman in multiple layers, if you read the book, you'll find out exactly how she was dressed. She actually managed somehow to swim all the way to shore. And then having gotten to shore, she goes home, and she has a few choices now. She can have her servants and her slaves. You know, she's a very wealthy woman living in a villa with lots of staff. She can have them protect her. She can call out the Praetorian guards who are loyal to her because she is the daughter of their great hero, Germanicus. She didn't do that either. You know, she sent them away from the villa because she knew that the second attack was coming. And rather than put her people in harm's way, she chose to face her murderers alone. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is an immense human moment. So anything else that you want to say about this woman, you cannot say that she did not have courage.
One of the points that the authors make in a number of these books is how these women, even if they had terrible reputations in the spotlight of history, tried to open up trade routes, tried to wield their power in different ways, or wielded their power in the same way that men did, in which eliminating one's enemies was a very common and understood political tactic. So as we said, we don't have time to talk about all of them, but is there one, aside from Agrippina, who is your favorite or who particularly intrigued you that you want to be sure you tell us about?
Well, I am a huge fan of Tudor history, and so I would have to say Mary Tudor, who's called Bloody Mary. And the reason why she, I think, is also kind of iconic for this series is that, you know, the title of every single book includes a nickname that woman was given by her contemporaries. And I think each book tries to raise the question, was that nickname fair? And in Mary Tudor's case, I think it's especially enlightening that she was called Bloody Mary. And she was called Bloody Mary because in a time of religious strife, she sent about 300 Protestants to the stake. She burnt them. And that is a bloody and a dastardly thing. So you think, okay, she deserves Bloody Mary. But then you look at it from a different perspective and you think that her sister killed nearly as many for the exact same reasons, and she was called Good Queen Bess. Then you have to take a step back and then you think, why is one sister Bloody Mary and the other one Good Queen Bess? Well, you know, Bess won. Bess was on the side of the Protestants. England to this day is a Protestant country. If it had reverted to Catholicism, I'm willing to lay down money that the nicknames might have swapped. And then you have to look at Dad, you know. Their father was Henry VIII, who by some counts killed as many as 70,000. And yet his nickname is Great Harry. And so then you have to ask, well, now does the gender bias also play in there? It's really interesting. And I think that what I say to kids all the time when I visit them in schools is that as someone who writes history books, I want you to know that history books are written by one person, usually by the winner. So bring that knowledge with you when you read these books and start to question, is there more that we can discover here rather than just staying with the surface stereotype?
Sharin Yim Bridges is the editor and publisher most recently of The Thinking Girl's Treasury of Dastardly Dames. And she was kind enough to join us from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Happy Women's History Month to you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Michelle, for having me.